It's a real treat to have Trevor back. Trevor, how's it going?
Pretty good, pretty good. Hope you all are doing okay.
It's always great when you're on. We always go and, you know, the pod goes in unexpected directions. And Jess, how's it going?
It's going okay. It's getting warmer out here in LA, so that's a nice sign.
Yeah.
Making these property taxes kind of more worthwhile.
Yeah, I know. It's tax. You guys get two tax bills a year, I hear.
It's California, so it's like we kind of just get like molested every time we need something. So yeah, sure.
I don't know why I thought you were in Northern California. I think I might just stereotype because I know you have some kind of experience with tech. I might just mentally put you in Northern California.
It's all right. Yeah. It's all right. We're all coastal elites. We're getting the wall, depending on who starts the revolution. So whatevs.
I love L.A., but you know, I love in L.A. that people from L.A. like really judge me for. I love Erewhon. I know you're not supposed to like it, and it's like bougie and whatever, but the food there is so fucking good. Like, I know it's like overpriced, but it's like that breakfast food is like really good to me.
I mean, like, you're supposed to kind of hate it in that whole like liberal self-loathing kind of way, but like the sales numbers don't lie. They're putting up branches everywhere. There's rich people. So clearly we don't hate it.
Yeah.
Is it really that shockingly expensive?
It depends on what you get. I mean, like, yeah. there's some shakes that are like, I never ordered those. Like things like the coffee and the breakfast stuff. I don't know why I'm answering. I should let Jessica answer because she has more experience than I do. But
you know, like how stores have loss leaders. Erewhon has the opposite of that. So there's stuff that's like eye-poppingly expensive that they know will get onto like social media. Stuff like $18 for one strawberry or $70 for like a jar of sea moss or some crazy stuff like that.
And it's some expensive Hailey Bieber juice or shake, right?
Yeah, like they do a rotating like celebrity smoothie at their like smoothie bar that's always like somewhere in the $20 range. But like if you just pop in for like Trevor, like you said, like coffee and a breakfast sandwich or something, like it's not like you're paying an LA premium, but honestly, like it was expensive, but then after they actually didn't raise their prices so much. So like now every other grocery store or every other joint is kind of inflating, like with inflation and all, like it's suddenly not that bad. Because they kept their price elevated, but consistently elevated, while everyone else is doing like a dollar or two like increases every like half year or so. So at this point, it's kind of just like par for the course now.
Like their hot food bar was decently priced. Like I'm on the website now, right? And let's say decently priced. I mean, decently priced for an expensive, bougie, free range type place. But like
exactly, yeah.
A organic rotisserie chicken whole is about $23.
That's so bad.
Yeah, it's expensive, but it's not like so bad.
It's not like you got to be rich to buy that.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So I mean,
I'm ride or die the Costco $5 chicken. So like.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so I would probably never buy that $23 organic chicken.
Is it not $6 now? It's still $4.99.
Maybe it is. I don't know.
Okay.
Whatever it is, like that's my ride or die for chickens. So I probably never will buy the $24. But like, in light of things, like yeah, it's not so bad. Like $10 for a breakfast sandwich, like okay, like it's not like I'm doing that every day or something.
Do you remember that place, Boston Market?
I yeah. loved Boston Market.
Okay, so they're like way going out of business, right? And
they're already dead.
They're hanging on. And
having had like multiple bankruptcies, I feel like it's amazing how it just keeps hanging on.
It's like hanging on for dear life. And there's this channel that I watch called UA Eats, which is a pretty it's like a East Coast food channel by this like Asian dude, and it's very comforting for some reason. And he does this thing where he'll go to like Dying Chains just to check it out. And he goes to, there's like one Boston Market left in New Jersey. And he goes there and like, there's no one, like he walks in, there's like literally no one there. And this woman comes out and you could still order the items and she puts it together and everything's rancid. He was like the mac and cheese almost made him literally throw up. And he's not dramatic. Like he was like, there's something wrong with this. The mashed potatoes almost was sour and it smelled bad. He was like, I think this went bad. And then the lady kept telling him like all the prices on the menu. She's like, oh, they're wrong. They're actually more than that. And then she was like, he tried to pay with card and she was like, it would be better if you paid cash.
Oh, wow.
Just got super weird.
Wow.
Do you think it's even still like owned by the franchise or is this like a rogue Boston Market? Like the franchise headquarters doesn't even know it's open?
It's so bad at this point that the franchise basically says you can open a Boston Market without paying a fee. They just want to sell you, you know, the food now. But yeah, you don't have to pay a franchise fee.
They're probably all like virtually rogue, as in like, you know, just open it, do whatever you want to give us, and then you're on your own. Like probably no support.
Yeah, it's crazy. But yeah, it's super sad, and it's also because it used to be really like pretty good.
Yeah,
yeah.
But now it's just like, yeah, it's a total. It's not just bad. It's like it's gone rogue, as G says. It's gone rogue and it's creepy. But yeah. Anyway, all right. So I gathered y'all here because last time we did a pod, I think was it when we did the bonus part of it or whatever. But we started talking about like the impact of Jewish culture and how I think Trevor, you said this, and I didn't fully. I had a vague idea of what you meant, but I didn't fully understand what you were trying to say. And you were saying that a lot of like American culture, what passes for just sort of like normie American culture, actually has like Jewish origins. And I've been watching a lot of like, not a lot, but I've been watching quite a few Jewish movies, like Jewish American movies. They're not necessarily by Jewish filmmakers. Like I watched Quiz Show. It's about Jewish people and they're like the way they interact with goyim, I guess is the term. But
Gentiles.
But that was like, it was actually by Robert Redford directed that, which is very interesting because he starred in this other movie that I watched called The Way We Were, and there's some connections between it. Quiz Show is about, it's a real life story. It actually happened, but it's about the way NBC sort of would tip the scales in this live television game show. And a Jewish guy from Queens was like winning all the time. He's on a hot win streak. He was sort of like the Ken, whatever that Jeopardy guy is. You know, it was like the perennial, like he just won. You know, he was on a hot win streak, and then NBC was like, yeah, but he's too Queens Jewish. And then they had Ralph Fiennes. They tilted the scale so he would take a fall and Ralph Fiennes would take over because Ralph Fiennes was more of like a well-bred
Anglo-Saxon
type.
Like upper blue, like Brahmin, yeah. White Brahmin type.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they wanted to change the look of the show. And I thought that was a real, that movie was a great, it was a great, like you could make that movie, I think, when it comes to like the way Asian kids like want to get into Harvard. And it was done, it wasn't, I don't know, we could talk about that somewhat, like the movie. I'm not trying to go through the movie, but I watched that movie. And then I watched Annie Hall. And Annie Hall, I think, was 1979 by Woody Allen. Won the best picture and a best director, best actress, all this shit, best screenplay. And I was like, this movie is like a prototype for all of the 90s sitcoms we were talking about on that last show. Like you could see right in the beginning, you could see Seinfeld where.
Yeah, totally. Seinfeld's like almost like a secular Annie Hall.
Oh, you noticed that too before? Like that's like an obvious connection, you think?
I mean, to me, but there's also like, you know, papers are written about it and everything, like comparing Annie Hall to Seinfeld and things like that. Yeah, it's that's kind of like a blueprint for this type of urban type of cosmopolitan, like, I don't know what you would call it, not a melodrama, but like a kind of comedy. Yeah,
it's sort of like a self-aware.
It captures sensibilities of a certain segment of urban people. I won't even call them elite because I don't think it was elite coded necessarily. The time it was created. Yeah.
I agree. I feel like I want to say elite because of how they say coastal elites now. But you're right; it's not really elite. Like, you know.
It's just captured a certain kind of package of anxieties and like predispositions and obsessions. If you were of a certain type of person in a particular time and place.
I think they were elite aspirants, no? I mean, they were like trying to... They were Manhattanites, and they were not... Like, he was... He actually played a Seinfeld character.
It's not quite elite, and I think this is what defines it. It's that they were elite adjacent enough, like close enough to see but not touch. Like, that forms like a big nexus of the anxiety. Like, very close to it... Like in the case of Quiz Show, like he had actually achieved it on its face, and then it turned out to be a completely rigged game. Stuff like that. Like dating the pretty white girl, but tripping over his own bag of like psychological baggage or something and gets in the way. Stuff like that.
Yeah, but like he has aspirations, right? Like he has elite aspirations and they're all Manhattanites and they run in circles that are directly connected to elites. I think, isn't Paul Simon like playing himself in this movie, right? Like, and then she goes out to Hollywood and she's like Annie Hall. After they break up, she goes to like Hollywood and starts sort of being, she's on like a Don Draper's girlfriend arc out in LA, you know, that whole thing. Yeah. And I'm not saying they're elite in the sense that they're powerful people, but I'm saying that they're living within the cultural context of a sort of like urban, sophisticated urban, you know, hyper. He's super educated, and he's also like kind of famous. Like he plays a Seinfeld character. He is a stand-up comic, right?
Right.
And he's like pretty successful, but not like super successful. And then there, Annie Hall, who is not Jewish, who is played by Diane Keaton. She's just like a Wisconsin white girl. Did you feel like, I don't know if you saw this, but when I was watching it, she has this sort of like really sort of like nervous, tick, self-conscious, awkward white girl thing that I felt was like, I was like, this is like Rachel, Monica, and Phoebe like all rolled into like one.
Sure. Also, what's her name? Julia Louis-Dreyfus' character. Elaine. That kind of like bundled like anxious neurotic female energy, the whole like displaced, not quite feeling secure in the big city. So like I think it ties into what we were kind of tapping into last time, where it's essentially like a gateway. But like that era of time was kind of like media was about like discussing the average white person's transition to big city life.
I think like, a good
they all have backstories from like the Midwest or something, so it's all about like how to fit into the big city.
I think a good transitional work that is in this kind of mode is When Harry Met Sally. I think if you put When Harry Met Sally in the mix,
yeah,
it's kind of in there too. The guy's clearly Jewish, but he's a little less Jewish than Woody Allen presents. And the girl is waspy, but with a little bit of Jewish neuroticism. Which I think Annie Hall has, which I think the character of Elaine has. And it keeps coming up. Like, I think Knocked Up is like the 2000s millennial version of that too, with Seth Rogen, you know, presenting more Jewish, and Katherine Heigl.
When you Jewish see it, coded? Maybe I didn't wasn't picking up on it.
Seth, like, I find Seth Rogen to be super Jewish.
Coded. Yeah, Seth Rogen himself is like at, not is he so actually a character, Jewish? But he himself, he himself and his he's I mean, as he gets older, he's becoming more Jewish coded. Like, he did a whole movie where he played like a Hasidic guy of some type. You guys ever see the ads for that one? It was interesting.
No. Is it? It's out. Like, it's old. Like, it's already been out.
It came out, but it wasn't very well received. It had to do with pickles. It was
what? Okay,
it's a pickles movie.
Yeah. He played. It was actually.
Oh, can't fuck with the pickles.
Yeah. If you Google Seth Rogen in American Pickle, and see the poster for it, it's a pretty interesting. Pictures from it, like do an image search for Seth Rogen, American Pickle. He was playing a Jewish immigrant pushcart peddler who I think ends up like out of time or something and transport. I don't remember exactly what the plot was, but it was very poorly received from what I saw.
But Annie Hall, just like, okay, I guess the reason it really stuck out to me was like, I always thought that 90s. Sitcom, that 90s sitcom style was sort of sui generis, in that it just sort of like was a product of its time, you know. When we first talked about it, I was kind of thinking about it like, oh yeah, that makes sense, because the 90s was a time when, you know, it was more of a neoliberal era and all this stuff. I still kind of think that's true, but at the same time, like, I can see how Annie Hall in 1979 was creating the foundation for that already, but Annie Hall like spelled it out more clearly. It was much more directly about a Jewish man and a non Jewish white woman. There are like scenes where the joke is that he's this extremely self-aware Jewish man from, I think he's from Manhattan, and he's both like extremely of this sort of like Upper West Side socialist Jew, you know, sort of background. He's from Coney Island, but remember he met that girl and he was saying that she was like, you know, sort of like an upper class Jew, and he was familiar with her type, and then he didn't want to date her. She was pretty into him, but then and she wanted to sleep with him that night, and he kept sort of dodging and delaying, and then finally said, like, I don't want to be a part of any club that would have me as a member, therefore.
Oh yeah, the girl that was like doing the announcing, like the like coordinating backstage at the show, right? Young girl. Yeah. And then he kind of like points at her, and you're like, and then like lists off, rattles off a whole list of like where she went to school, that she's a socialist, that she's a Jewish socialist.
She's working on her thesis.
She's working on her thesis. And then she just responds like, I just love being reduced to an ethnic stereotype, but still like comes on to him.
Yeah. 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 He won't do it. And he says at that moment, he was like, actually in the very beginning of the movie, where it's just like a sort of introductory voiceover, he said that the defining joke of his life is that joke about how he would never want to be part of a club that would have him as a member.
That was a holy shit moment. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's a theme that pops up in like Philip Roth books too, which I used to read quite a bit. I used to read a lot of Jewish authors, and then like from like a generation or two prior, like from the 30s, like a lot of Irish authors, because I felt like they wrote about the immigrant experience.
I know Chris is a big fan of Philip Roth. I've never read any of his books, but yeah.
They're really good.
Yeah. I feel like Jewish American novels have a very specific feel to them. Like, even if the person isn't like observant Jew, like for example, like J.D. Salinger, he's half Jewish and he's not technically Jewish, but I feel in a lot of ways he's culturally Jewish. Like his books, like Franny and Zoe and Catcher in the Rye, there is something that you can feel like you're reading something influenced by a Jewish American novel. And like, you know, it's interesting. Nora Ephron is Jewish, who did You Got Mail and When Harry Met Sally, like I said. And she has an interesting take on the difference between a Jewish, I wish I could find it, difference between a Jewish and a Christian romantic comedy. And this is her quote. She says, external forces separate lovers in a Christian romantic comedy, while characters' neuroses obstruct happiness in a Jewish romantic comedy. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's a big theme in kind of Jewish fiction in general, like Jewish American fiction, that, you know, it's your internal hangups and your neuroses and your inner struggles that are getting in the way as much as, or your hangups or whatever, like, that are getting in the way as much as, what, or more so than whatever is happening outside, you know?
Yeah, that's definitely going on, at least between him and, well, I guess it goes on between him and Annie Hall, too. Yeah, and the whole thing is about...
Yeah, like compare his relationship with Annie versus, like, that young, very beautiful, like, Jewish leftist that he keeps, like, pushing, like, keeping at, like, arm's distance.
Here's an interesting parallel, too, right? And this is what I was saying about how, like, you know, people talk about there's a way to be, like, wannabe white or wannabe black, or, you know, could be wannabe Asian, like a weeb, you know, or... people who are into, like, you know, Chinese culture. I've met, like, white or black people into Chinese culture and stuff. But because Jewish American culture is kind of not given the name, no one really thinks about wanting to be Jewish. But something like Master of None is very much... is he Pakistani? In fact, that's a Pakistani...
I think he's Indian. It's Kumail who's Pakistani.
Yeah.
Oh, so he's Indian. Okay, I know he's Muslim.
Aziz, right?
Aziz is Indian Muslim. Yeah. Then okay, yeah, but that's very, very Woody Allen-ish. The same way Woody Allen always kind of has, or a lot of these Jewish romantic comedies is always a Jewish guy with a neurotic Gentile, like. He kind of has the same thing with, like, you know, I guess you could put Kumail in that category. You can put Rami from that sitcom Rami, like, you know, this kind of ethnically religious, neurotic, urban guy, you know, who's doesn't really quite click when he tries to date with women in his own culture, same way like Woody Allen doesn't really click with the Jewish leftist girl. Is she, if I remember right, she played by Carol Kane?
Or I don't know.
I'm going off of memory. But, you know, in...
I think that sounds right.
In Big Sick, you know, he's going on all those arranged dates with the brown girls, and it's just not, like, you know, working. You know, he's not feeling it as much as he idealized. Same with the dates with brown girls that Aziz goes on with in Master of None. There's always something wrong with him, man. His heart really lies with the white girl. I feel like that's straight out the Woody Allen Jewish male, Gentile, female love interest romantic comedy trope that comes up a lot, you know.
And yeah, I feel like they're
creating, like, Annie Hall is all, I mean, the character Annie Hall, I feel like she's also a construction here, where it's like, it's not just that she's white, it is that she's white, but it's also that she, like, sort of is a refugee, like, from her own family, or her own basically her own family, where she's kind of trying to run away from her family because she doesn't like them. And then she goes to visit, they both go to visit her family, I think in Wisconsin, and it's sort of a nightmare. And, you know, she's got that famous scene where he's sitting and then the grandmother's just staring at him. And then Woody Allen breaks the fourth wall and goes, the grandmother's a classic Jew hater. And then you see from her perspective that she sees Woody Allen sort of as like a Hasidic Jew with all, you know, like she really Jewifies him up in her mind's eye. And then he goes upstairs to talk to her brother, her little brother, who's played by Christopher Walken. And he's like out of his fucking mind. And he's telling him all these like really dark fantasies about wanting to like cross the yellow line when he's driving at night and just obliterate himself. And Woody Allen goes, I'm needed back on planet Earth, so I'm going to go downstairs. And so basically, like, she comes from this really like weird Protestant like horror show, you know, out in the boonies. And she's trying to escape into sort of like sophisticated white society, and there and is full of like this nervous energy, and that somehow makes the two of them a match. Do you know what I mean? Like that quirky, neurotic white girl who's a little bit out of her element and is unsure of herself is like catnip to the character he plays. And I'm not, I almost think like, I'm just saying like what the basis of the film was. I don't even think I'm reading into it. I think that he was trying to say that. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, I think that was very overt. I like, just side note, like, it was interesting how Annie Hall, like, her relationship to therapy is kind of, is a couple of decades ahead of its time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's, the movie just starts with her talking about, like, oh, I'm depressed because I didn't go to therapy today. This whole, like, white girl that's alienated from her family, who's, like, psychologically, like, emotionally dependent on therapy that's clearly not working. Like, desperately trying to find some kind of, like, stability or foundation. And then, like, running, like, the both of them are very, very visibly running away from essentially everything that they understand about themselves. So they're kind of completely alienated from themselves, even. I just thought that, like, her name-dropping, like, therapy so much, and that, like, complicated relationship to psychotherapy was kind of a, like, I think I don't know how it read in 1979, but, like, now it's almost like a stock trope, right? Like, now the twist would be that this woman is, like, an upper-class functional alcoholic or something, in addition to, like, addicted to pills and going to therapy three times a week.
Mm. I've seen a few late 70s, early 80s Manhattan films where women going into therapy is sort of like an... It's like a step towards sort of, like, liberation. I forgot... There was like a movie called like a, it's called A Married Woman or something like that. Pretty good movie. It's about a woman who gets a divorce, and like a big part of it is like, you know, her taking that step and going into therapy, and it's seen as sort of it's like a liberation type move. It's like a sophisticated move. It's,
I saw it as liberalism's conversion therapy. This is the step that takes you from a rube out from the Hicks into an urbanite, a fully in the know urbanite.
Yeah, I think it. Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think in the one I saw, it was in A Married Woman. It was more like. A step towards, it was like a feminist step almost.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? But
yeah.
In any event, I don't know. I just got the feeling that like you could see in the film and the film itself, because it was so well like received and it won the Oscar. It was such a, apparently it was such a huge phenomenon, like artistically and culturally in 79. Like it almost seemed, especially with the way like, Allen is like so brutal with white people. Like there's a scene where there's a lot of like these breaking, I don't know if it's, is it breaking the fourth wall or when they suspend reality and he does something that's
talk to the audience.
He'll talk to the audience, but this is the other one where he'll just go up to random people on the street and ask them questions and they'll respond. And it's
Oh, like when I talk about with Marshall McLuhan online, where he asked Marshall McLuhan to explain his own writing to the guy in the movie line, or
I get yes, that exactly like that. You mean in the beginning? when they're waiting for, to get into the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, like that. And, you know, and then it clearly isn't part of reality, right?
I guess that'd be called meta, going meta, I guess.
Yeah. There's this one part where he's, like, broken up with Annie, and she's, like, you know, kind of, like, worked up about it. So he'll go out. He sees this, like, really attractive white couple in Manhattan, and he just goes up to them and goes, hey, can I ask you a question? You know, like, how do you guys do it? How do you guys stay together? And the guy goes, well, you know, I don't really have a lot going on up here. I'm pretty shallow. So, you know, it doesn't really bother me that we don't have much to talk about. And then he goes to the woman. He was like, what about you? And she's like, I'm the same way. We're perfect for each other. Like, it's, I don't know. I just thought he's like very aggressive in this movie about how, you know, Annie Hall's grandmother is a Jew hater. Annie's brother is a psychopath. These random attractive white people on the street are, you know, just basically like
completely soulless and vapid.
Soulless and vapid, yeah. And it's barely played for day. He's just like, yeah, that's just what I see.
But think about Holden Caulfield. I was saying how that book feels has that kind of Jewish American tinge to it. And the whole book, he's always talking about how this person's a phony, that person's a phony, this person is this.
Yeah.
Even though technically he's a wasp in the thing, he also is an outsider. And I feel like that outsiderness he has from the rest of his wasp family kind of in a weird way codes him as a Jewish. But it's very strange because he's on paper 180 degrees from that. He's like from a well-to-do waspy family.
Yeah, but like,
yeah, and you see that in like Philip Roth, like very overtly like Jew, not even Jew coded. Like that is a Jew. These are Jewish characters, like basically indicting what they see in America, but also kind of wrestling with the fact that they are part of this now. It's what Asian American literature could have been if we still had balls.
Yeah.
But it turned into weepy self-confessionals. But so
I feel like the Jewish stuff takes it to another level where it seems like it almost seems like they're prototyping a kind of new culture for urban elites where they don't really know like the white establishment or the American establishment. I don't know if it's strictly like white, but I think it's mostly white. But like they didn't really know how to move forward culturally into sort of the modern era, and it almost seems like they were like Woody Allen was a type of like pioneer in sort of putting together a certain cultural sensibility about just like how to be. Do you know what I mean? Like I watched this stuff and it's like it's more than just the movie. Like I'm like, this became our culture. Like this is how people were.
Yeah, it became the blueprint for how to be urban and sophisticated and witty, you know, like as opposed to like say something like Dorothy Parker or something. Like this is something very different. I have a theory as to what you're talking about, Jess, with I find it, he said literally if it still had any balls, and I think that literally captures the problem. I think a interesting thing I feel or notice with Asian American cultures, I think it's different than a lot of other minority or immigrant cultures in that it wasn't originally penetrated in the mainstream by men, but that I think Asian American culture kind of started very early with the female voice. And I think this story tends to be kind of a male outsider story, you know, because I think it's harder for men to be accepted in foreign communities than women. You know, like if a woman marries into a foreign community, I think there's this patriarchal idea that's easier to accept or absorb the female other than the male other. The male other is threatening to the hegemony. He's going to maybe keep his culture and pass it down and disrupt. Like I think there was a reason why Loving versus Virginia had to be done by a black woman and not started with a black man. And like with black Americans, with a lot of other cultures, like there was this period where, you know, the men kind of were the first celebrated luminaries, you know, and then the movement for the females came after. But I feel like for Asian American penetration into the mainstream, it's like the early prominence from the beginning was really the female Asian Americans. I don't know if you guys feel the same way, but I feel like things like Joy Luck and Maxine Kwok, is it? And Kingston,
Maxine Hong Kingston.
Yeah. Maxine yeah. Hong Kingston. Like all the names I could think of, even if I haven't read them, all the ones I could think of are always
No, women. You're right. Even into the modern era, like Chiang Rai-Lee, I believe, got a lot of like literary acclaim, but nobody in the mainstream knows his work.
Yeah, I never heard that name either until you just said it.
Like Native Son. It actually is quite in line with Native previous era. Yeah, Native Speaker. Sorry. You're right. A lot of the main voices were female. However, I've said this before in years prior, and I will continue to die on this hill. Amy Tan deserves another look.
Yeah, I wanted to pot about her, about Joy Luck Club, about yeah, the book. Though I will say, one of the problems with the book is it's incredibly boring from today's perspective, in my opinion.
But I understand that. I'm saying just in terms of the theme, like I remember reading that book like as a kid. I think it was required reading in like middle school or high school, and it's entirely it's actually a criticism, a deep criticism, subtle but it's deep, a criticism of America. It's written from the perspective of family of like generations of women, but it's entirely like why America will corrupt your soul and cut you off from your family. Mm. And ruin you.
Yeah, I agree. I've always thought it was like that because I read the book before I saw the movie. I don't remember the movie, but
the movie probably bastardized and distorted it all to hell, and nobody reads anymore. So you see, like you see the edgelords on the internet talk about how Amy Tan is like whoring generations of Asian American women out to white men, and that's the 180 from what it actually is.
And it probably also is a victim of. People going off one person's take on another person's take on another person's take on the movie
year after year.
Yeah.
So it becomes like the game of telephone, and just keeps propagating. I think part of the reason why Joy Luck Club resonated is maybe kind of the same reason why movies like Annie Hall or Philip Roth's work or something really does like penetrate. Americans really like to be criticized at some level.
I agree. I think that's going on with The White Lotus right now.
I think that's why
people love that show so much. Yeah.
People like they are craving this kind of like emotional like spiritual castigation.
I think that it's these a form
like
of
slight outs. Yeah, like this slight slight like insider outsider tension. If you do it artistically, it just hits.
But there's a there's a scene going to this point about if it had any balls. They're like Quiz Show, I think, is a movie that had balls, partially because it was Robert Redford that made it. So he's cut, like, he can make the claims on behalf of the Jewish characters that he's writing. But, one of the things I liked about it, he had different levels of Jews in that movie, and Totoro.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that. Yeah.
So Totoro is like a Queens Jew, right? Like he's an unassimilated, like towny Jew in like deep Queens. Right. And I forgot the name, but he's the government investigator guy, and he's more of like a striving, you know, half assimilated Jew, but he's extremely smart, right? So he's self-respecting. He's a self-respecting Jew. He's aware of when people are being, you know, like anti-Semitic and all this stuff. But he went to Harvard Law. He knows how to sort of play, you know, the role
and
whatever, right? And so all the way at the end when they're having that big, you know, the congressional hearings about this Quiz Show scandal, he sort of makes a deal with Ray Fiennes, who's the sort of like blue-blooded white guy, that he won't call him to testify and incriminate himself, right? And instead, he has Totoro's character go up and Stemple. And Stemple goes up and sort of makes incriminates himself and sort of makes a he like exposes himself as a fraud because he was also getting the answers, right?
But kind of like playing the clown too, so he was okay with like the laughs he was getting.
He was hoarding the camera for the laugh. Right. And so I forgot the name, the lawyer, right? The government lawyer that sets this whole thing up. Mm-hmm. His wife, who's Jewish, she at one point is just screaming at him at home, and he doesn't get why. And he was like, and she said it, she spells it out for him. She goes, because you're willing to crucify Stemple in there. I don't know if he used the word crucify, but like you're willing to crucify Stemple in public, but you're going to protect Van Dorn. You're going to protect Ralph Fiennes. You're like the, she literally says, you're like the Uncle Tom of the Jews. You know?
Yeah.
And I was like,
because he's like, he's bending over backwards to protect like the prince of the wasps.
He is.
Right? While letting the Jew like make a fool out of himself, essentially, on camera.
He is. And it's very subtle because you see him doing it the whole time. Like, you see him becoming friends with Van Dorn. You see him promise Van Dorn that I'm going to call out your show. These things are coming out, but don't worry, I'll spare you. And you see him doing it, and you're almost, it's not done in a way that sounds nefarious up until the point his wife explains to him what she thinks he's doing. And I was like, damn, this movie has balls to say that. You know what I mean? Like, because Stemple is not really that, it's interesting because he's not really that, he's really not that that sympathetic of a character, because he's very Jewy in that sense. Like, all the bad stereotypes about him actually do apply. He's extremely self-centered.
He's willing to cheat. He's grasping. He's willing to cheat.
Yeah, and he's like an attention seeker, and you know all this stuff. You know, he's not really that likable in this movie. But the wife still is like, yeah, but he's a Jew, and you're willing to sacrifice him in order to preserve your relationship with Van Dorn, who's just as bad. And I was like, damn, this movie's got balls. I honestly can't imagine an Asian American film doing something like that.
There would be a weird cop out.
Yeah.
That kind of so you know that they see the ideological conflict and they're just like, we have to patch this over as fast as we can.
They wouldn't even go there.
Yeah, like, possibly.
With the Asian American films now, it's like all about the resolution of some conflict inside of the Asian character's mind.
Right.
You know, and it's like, well,
like, this was all in your head. Everything's fine.
My desire to do this and that.
Mm-hmm. Something interesting is that I feel like that wave of brown comedians was kind of wading into this arena, like in the 2010s or whatever, when for whatever reason there was like a couple of them coming out at once, like
Kumail.
Kumail, Rami, I forget his last name, and but he had the show on Hulu, and Aziz Ansari, but something ended up being
Hassan Minhaj.
Oh, that's another one.
Hassan Minhaj.
Yeah.
Even though
I
don't think he's ever explored those outsider assimilation. Well, actually, in his comedy, actually, he did when he talked
does.
About.
He said he wanted to take that white girl to prom or something.
Yeah,
right?
You're right. Actually, he does talk about it in his comedy. So that's the same thing. But there's something. Well, actually, Hassan's at least was willing to go to a more uncomfortable place as far as, like, you know, bigotry and whatever. I hate how after we did that episode, the clarification came out, and I was like, damn, because it was like, I would have done it. For people don't know, Jess and Chris came on to talk about it after it happened, and we analyzed it with nothing but the New York Magazine story as an ammunition. And then when the clarification about it came out, I was like, oh, this is really weird on a whole different level. And he's kind of very vindicated in a lot of ways. But like, that episode is just like stuck there now. And I'm like, I wish I don't care enough to ever go back and revisit it. But I hate that that's our final word on it. But that's a whole different story. But no, you're absolutely right. Like, that's probably the one with the most teeth. But I feel like Kumail's and Aziz's don't really have anything to say except, yeah, I can get the white girl after all, and it's fine. You know, like, there's no real interrogation of what is this doing to me? What is there something off with me about, do I hate myself? Like, it's not really explored at all. There is a show that I think is a very good black Jewish type of thing. Have you heard of this show called Love Life on HBO? It's an anthology series, and season two had a black guy who is played by the guy from The Good Place, the William Jackson Harper. And that one is really interesting. I should have told Jesse to watch that one. I didn't even think about it until real time just now. But that's a very black wannabe Jewish story, Jewish American story to me. Like it's about a black guy who has only dated like white women, and then he marries a white woman, and he ends up losing her because he has this emotional affair. He attempts to like consummate it with a black girl, and it's a really weird show that goes interesting places. Like, I think she finds his text to her or whatever, and they're like, I think even making fun of her because she's white and stuff. And she ends up divorcing him, and he goes through this really bad divorce, post-breakup guilt thing. And he ends up, over the years, like, touching base and falling out of contact with the black girl that he lost a relationship over.
He's a white guy?
No, he's a black guy. He's a black guy, but it feels very Woody Allen-ish. Throughout. I mean, the way that he's kind of neurotic, he's very neurotic. He has issues with his with how he views himself as a ethnic person, and also with dating women of his own race or whatever, and how he navigates that. But it I think it's interesting as it goes, I think, some ballsy places with the questioning, the self-hate and all that stuff, you know what I mean, in a way that I feel like Aziz and Kumail
they don't do it right.
Yeah, they don't do it at all. And I feel like Woody Allen, you know, if I remember correctly, he did interrogate that. So
Woody Allen, I feel, is so fucking ruthless.
Yeah.
And that movie has so much balls, because Woody Allen begins with the very like first fucking sentence that you hear in that movie is like, the basis of my entire life is this joke. And then later, when he rejects the Jewish girl for being too Jewish and too similar, he's like, here's the joke. And then he never apologizes for it. He never cares or worries about it. He's just like, that's who I am.
That joke is, I would never want to be a part of a club that would have me as a member. Is that
right?
Yeah.
So he's like, and so that's why I want these white women.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he doesn't care. It doesn't bother him. He's just like, that's what it is. And that's how it's going to be. And then, but he also doesn't suck up, because the reason she doesn't want him is because he's such an arrogant asshole that she keeps telling him, like, the reason you don't, she's like, I want you to marry me. He's like, and you're not going to, because you think I'm stupid. And he was like, just because I'm telling you to go to community college for classes doesn't mean I think you're stupid. But he's such an arrogant bastard. And there's an arrogance to him that I never see in the same kinds of thematic films from either black or Asian.
There's a self-assured acceptance.
When it comes to this.
Yeah, there's a sense of self, like he's neurotic and full of anger and all of that, but he kind of accepts that about himself.
Yeah, and actually,
and turning this into a sappy love story. I think if in the hands of the modern like Asian American sensibility, then the way this wraps up is that an angelic white person who defies all of his previously held assumptions comes and, like, he does marry her or something. Or the white guy shows up, and somehow conveniently, you know, you end up with the white person, but all of the conflicts have been magically erased.
And it actually makes me want to walk back a compliment I gave to Love Life, because I think one thing that Love Life does that is not what Woody Allen does is that he does kind of get redeemed. Like, he gets, like, more in touch with his blackness. He ends up getting with the black girl, and they don't quite explicitly say that there's something wrong with him for having been with the white woman before, but it still feels kind of implied. Like, he has to, I guess, he doesn't fully all the way, I don't want to use the word sell out, but he doesn't fully all the way get with the white person with no type of commentary or real self-examination the way Kumail or Aziz do, you know, where it's like it's just presented as the prize and that's that. There is, like, some self-criticism or whatever, but he does totally acquiesce to the criticism and accept the indictment and, you know, changes. Like, that's his character arc. Whereas I think what makes Woody Allen interesting, as you're making me realize when both of you talk, is that he does bring up all this stuff, which, you know, the brown stuff doesn't, but he also doesn't, like, do penance for it the way
he literally doesn't give a shit. Yeah
And I think that's, like, probably more ballsy than all the examples we're thinking of. And I think Seinfeld's another example of handling it toothlessly as well. Like it never really comes up much that he's Jewish and that most of his girlfriends are coded as Gentile.
I was gonna say that for Seinfeld, I feel like, yeah, no, they do bury that stuff more, because I think I feel like what Seinfeld was, if you ask me, is it took Annie Hall and it stripped it of all of this sort of, like, more explicit racial, I guess we'll call it ethnic or racial class negotiations that were going on. Mm-hmm. But it kept the form, and it sort of took out all that stuff and sort of, like, submerged it underwater a little bit.
You know what it was like? It was like the Disney version of any fairy tale.
Yeah.
How they always kind of, like, take the edges off of it. You know, people who died in a fairy tale don't die, you know, and stuff like that. The Little Mermaid doesn't commit suicide. She, you know, lives happily ever after. It was very... It was like a Disney-ish,
a bit Disney-fied, yeah.
Yeah, a Disney-fied Annie Hall.
But you know, like, how Larry David had this motto called "No hugging, no learning," and it was like the characters do not hug and they don't learn. Like, there's no making up, there's no learning. Like, they're just who they are, and
it's arrested development. It's permanent, like, arrested development.
Mm. Yeah, but they never... But that's the thing, is, like, there's a certain arrogance to that, in the sense of, like, I don't think my characters need to learn. We don't need to change. We don't need, like... they just sort of sit back, like the Seinfeld characters, they just sort of sit back, and they are in a... What did you say last time, Trevor, that they... live in a hostile world or something?
I feel like a big part of a lot of Jewish American stuff, I think you even see it, like, in kind of Jewish stuff, there's this sense of the mob, like the mob is hostile and how do you put it? It's a very misanthropic view of humanity. I think it makes sense for a group of people who, for a lot of the times, the mob means something bad. You know what I mean? Like, the mob means a pogrom or something. But also, even the mob within the Jewish community, there's like this, I don't really know how to put it, but the mob is a character in and of its own right. And there's this kind of sense of, people There's like a kind of morality in the mob, but you have to like pull it out of them, kind of. But you know, at the end of the day, like it's a brutal, hostile world. Especially if you're in an urban environment, you know, like it's a very doggy. Okay, I'll give an example, right? Like if you read something like what's a good example of what I'm talking about? I know that urban.
You can do it. You're setting up something real good.
Yeah, I just want an example. Like I can think of it. The best example I could think of, but I don't know if it's mainstream enough, right? Like if you look at something like Spider-Man, and that's like a how J. Jonah Jameson is always whipping up New York against Peter Parker and always calling him like a bum. And you know, Spider-Man's like a menace, and like no matter what he does, it's like he's very neurotic. You know, Stan Lee is a Jewish guy. Like he's very neurotic, and
I didn't know Stan Lee was Jewish.
Just about everybody in comics is Jewish. The superhero itself is Jewish. It's if you want to get into that, that's a whole. It's easier to count.
All right, T, you're coming back on the show in like what 4 weeks? We got a new can to open up.
Yeah, it's like it's easier to count on a single hand the amount of non-Jewish people who created major superheroes than to count the Jewish people. Like, there's one. Steve Ditko is Slavic. He's the co-creator of Spider-Man. And who else is there? I think that's the only one I could think of. Yeah, everyone else is Jewish. But you know, like in the Marvel comics, there's always this sense of like the mob is like barely grateful. They're you save all these people, and you know they're barely grateful. But you go and do it anyway, and there's no. You know, I know there's going to be an example that's going to hit me as soon as you stop recording. But the way that they kind of send the four Seinfeld people to jail at the end, and everybody just gangs up on them and finally gets rid of them. Like, they're, I think there is this way in which the masses, the mob is, there's a kind of cynical idea about them
Are you talking about like maybe like a Hobbesian view where?
Yeah. Short uh-huh. British existence.
Like Yeah.
Hobbesian. Yeah. Leviathan. That's a very good example. I tried to look up an example and I put the mob in Jewish literature and instead I got the mafia. So that doesn't help. I got the Jewish mafia because I wanted to search for an example of.
Are you saying that the mob here represents sort of like the real underlying social order around us? Like there's a sort of like mobbiness to society at large, or are you talking about literally the mob?
Like, okay.
Yeah, I'm having a little trouble closing the loop on that.
It's kind of baked into even the Old Testament. Like every time, the Israelites are left to their own devices, they just start doing something crazy. They start like making golden calves, and like Moses goes away just for a little bit to talk to God, and they start like freaking out and start saying God forsaken us. Start making golden calves or whatever, and then Moses comes back and it's like, oh my God, like I can't leave you guys alone for a minute, you know, and they have to be smited, they have to have flood sent to get them in check. Like this time you just gotta reset everybody and just start over again. That's how God has to like send things down to Sodom and Gomorrah, just destroy them because like they've done it again. There's this kind of sense that like humanity left to its own devices and vices will just their vices and their neuroses will get the the better of them without a call to like a higher power.
Okay, so you're talking about like human nature is the mob in this case, in the generalized case?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's human nature is the mob, and it's not pretty.
And okay. I feel like you're making me think of like the Coen brother films and stuff, and I feel like there's a kind of cynicism in a lot of their movies that ties them all together, even though they're all different genres.
I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, I think
there's a bit of recursion in those movies where like one and amplified consequences, like one small mistake in like scene two of act one, like sets up like terrible consequences left unchecked in like act three.
Yeah.
And every single like foible or character quirk kind of builds upon itself with increasing consequences. Severity of
and everything's trending towards hell or chaos or, you know, something.
Yeah.
You know, like another example, if you think of the story of Jesus, like it is a Jewish story. It's written by Jewish people at the end of the day. Like even though it became Christianity and Christians are considered Gentiles, like the actual gospels are, when they were written at the time, you know, Jewish stories, and Jesus died a Jew, and that's a perfect example of like the crowd. The crowd basically turns on Jesus, like the Pharisees, the teachers, the rest of the Jewish people. Like that's a very, to me, Jewish story. Like the crowd.
So we're just sort of like floating in an ocean of like sort of human ignorance and avarice and. You're lucky to just float a little bit for a while with your sort of like, you know, humanity and soul intact, but eventually.
And they can be very fickle. That's the word that I'm looking for. There's like a fickleness to them. To the crowd.
Yeah,
they can turn on you, but, you know, you still have to have your internal. In the more positive stories, you have to have your internal compass. You know, like there's a lot of stories in the Bible where the crowds are turning on somebody, they're doing things, but the person has to maintain their faith in God in the face of all these crowds, where there's Jesus asking, "Why have you forsaken me?" And people are, you know, throwing stuff and taunting him, or like Job gets thrown off the boat because they blame him for... why they're about to die in a storm, and like a whale eats them, but throughout it, he maintains his faith in God, and God rewards him. Like there is,
yeah. You know, I was thinking about this because it kind of sounds too bleak to be like, why would you believe this? Why would you think this? But like the opposite of it almost seems to be the Protestant view, where if you're on like sort of like the right path of, you know, got sort of like God, that you will constantly be rewarded with signs that you're doing the right thing. You'll be rewarded with like
your
sort
path
of like
will be well ordered. You will
You'll make money. Your health is going to improve. Yeah. Your hair is going to be shiny.
A hot partner will come your way, and that's the fortuitous meet cute.
Yeah, and so the better you do, the more you're sort of following the breadcrumbs of like God.
Oh, it's prosperity gospel.
Prosperity gospel.
Totally.
Whereas I guess what you're saying is like the Jewish worldview seems to say, and I mean, isn't this like, I guess Job is that story, right? Is like, just because you have faith and you're on the right path of like faith doesn't mean you're going to get rewarded. In fact, you might get punished.
Yeah, yeah. And you might get tested and whatever. And it makes sense for a group of people who were always kind of hounded and chased place to place because of their faith. Like, you know, I think it's harder to think that if you're on the right path, nice things gonna happen to you all the time, you know, because then they wouldn't have stuck with Judaism as long as they did. Like I think it behooves them more to think like, you know, you're gonna be hounded and, you know, get a lot of bad treatment for doing the right thing, but it's, you know, stick to your tribe and whatever, and you know, God is just testing you, you know. It's there is this way. Like, have you ever seen I feel like there's a more of an optimism toward human nature and the crowd in Gentile and WASP work that is not really in the Jewish American.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I think like what we're about to talk about is super fascinating. Do you think we could? You think it's you have time to do this in a bonus pod, and we'll end the free pod here.
Yeah, it works for me.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's okay. A good part to.
All right.
To cut it. I might have to bounce in a little while. Like, are you guys free tomorrow? We'll just do some
time, Jess. That's fine.
Okay, because this is super fascinating, actually. Like, and I have a lot of more
to say. I feel like it'll help me get my thoughts together on it better. Because, like I said, I have no handy examples except for like a few that I just brought up. But I feel like there's better cultural ones.
Yeah, let's circle back on this.
No, also, I mean, I could finish with Trevor. If you've got time, we could, because I kind of want to get a bonus down. But okay. Jeff, we could do another one if you got to bounce.
Yeah, then I'll just stop here, and then you guys can take over. Okay. Yeah, okay, and then we'll. But like, I want to revisit this with UT at some other point too.
Oh yeah, for sure, for sure.
Because like a point that I want to I kind of wondered while watching Annie Hall, and you're talking about like how this captures our moment. Like, this is weird. It's weirdly prescient for the current moment, and I kind of wonder if it's that the current social order is decaying. I wonder if that's what's kind of looping us back around to this early, to maybe an earlier sensibility that Jewish creators kind of crafted back in the day. Like, I kind of wonder if America had stayed on its like hegemonic like. On top of the world order, right there, what like we were still in the America like boom years. I wonder if it would have seemed a little bit more outdated by now. But like now, when we're talking about themes of like alienation, neuroticism, anxiety, like material deprivation, stuff like that, like always being kind of class anxious.
Why do you have to ask this question? I want to talk about this. I want to just answer your question.
Okay, I'll. You know what? Fuck it. Sure. Yeah. Let's do this. Let's do this.
This is the end of part one of a two-part podcast. Part two is on the Patreon feed. To get access to bonus episodes, go to patreon.com/planningmech.